This is Rosario Martinez. Captain Malcolm, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the appellant? And Lieutenant Barnes, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government? Very well then, please proceed.
Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, and may it please the court, I'm Captain Catherine Malcolm, and I represent the appellant, Corporal Rosario Martinez. I respectfully request 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
The president of the panel wrote, "I would like to correct the findings and worksheet to accurately reflect the correct findings of the panel." Appellant was acquitted, but stands before this court.
Captain, can you pull that microphone just a wee bit closer to you?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, sir. Appellant was acquitted, but stands before this court convicted because of a mistake. The affidavit of the president in this case falls into a very narrow exception of admissibility allowed by MRE 606B2C. The military judge was incorrect to exclude it in its entirety and to deny production of the president of the panel at the post-trial 39A.
So, Captain Malcolm, when it comes to MRE 606B2C, it seems to be capturing those mistakes that are based on how the panel recorded its verdict. But you seem to be arguing that the mistake was based on how the panel reached its verdict. Isn't there an important distinction there?
Yes, Your Honor, there is a distinction. An appellant's argument is requesting just that narrow interpretation of a mistake in the findings worksheet. The language of the rule allows a member to testify or provide evidence if there's a mistake made in entering the finding or sentence on the finding or sentence form. And that's what happened in this case.
But in terms of determining that, it requires getting into the internal deliberations. It's, for lack of a better analogy, it seems as if what the rule is trying to capture, in terms of mistake, is a snapshot of improper circling of guilty instead of not guilty. It seems you're requesting that we look at this as a video, going back into internal deliberations, that ultimately at the end of that video results in the incorrect circling. Why should we, this court, view 606B2C as covering your approach?
Because in this case, Your Honor, what we're looking at really is a snapshot. So the error in this case is that the members incorrectly did not write down the finding of not guilty when they reached it. So the entirety of the president's affidavit in this case is not admissible under MRE 606B2C or other exceptions. But portions of it are and should have been considered by the military judge in this case. So the first part of line 8 is admissible under this rule, and it gets at that snapshot of when the error occurred when the members did not write down the verdict that they had reached. The senior member, the president, wrote, "We incorrectly did not complete the findings worksheet after each finding that would have resulted in a not guilty verdict." That indicates to the military judge what the error was, and that's admissible under the language of MRA 606B2C. And it mirrors the language that the federal courts have used when looking at the comparable federal rule.
How would we then distinguish this scenario where panel member comes in and says, "I voted incorrectly," something like that, where, again, this court would have to get into something beyond the incorrect circling of guilty? It seems as if the Supreme Court has warned appellate courts to steer completely clear of internal deliberations. And yet it seems as if you want us at a minimum to open that door to a certain extent and find out what was going on.
No, Your Honor, not in this case, and it's not required in this case. What we do have is admissible evidence from the affidavit that says we incorrectly did not write down the verdict of not guilty that we decided on. And then ultimately, the president concludes, I would like to correct the findings worksheet to accurately reflect the correct findings in the panel. And in the federal
court. But if the, let's say somebody parachuted into the middle right as they circled guilty, and they said to each panel member, is this how you voted? Is this how you voted? Is this how you voted? And at least three-fourths of them would say yes. So how was that a mistake at that point in time?
It was a mistake based on the admissible evidence that we do have available to us. And the military judge could have produced the president at the post-trial 39A to ask some questions, certainly could have asked the question of, is this the accurate verdict that you and the members agreed upon? And we can predict what the answer would have been, that no, it's not. The president had communicated as much in his affidavit.
But counsel, going back to that, see, that's that snapshot issue that the chief judge keeps going back to. The because we have the affidavit, we know there were multiple votes, and that ultimately they did vote to convict the appellant. So if even if the military judge asked the president of the panel, does this reflect the votes of the panel, the answer would be yes, albeit vote number 5 or vote number 6, but yes. So, again, how do we get around not having to pierce the deliberations to get back to the reason why there's a potential error? That's what I think we're trying to get at.
Because the members' description of any voting procedures is simply not admissible. The military judge could not have asked questions about that during the post-trial 39A, but what the military judge could ask is not just, is this what you voted, but mirroring the federal language, is this verdict accurately reflect the will of the jury? And it's clear from the affidavit of the senior member or the president that it what they wrote down does not accurately reflect their will, that it needs to be corrected, and that it does not reflect the correct findings of the panel.
Would this apply in a situation other than voting? I mean, let's suppose that the panel members vote guilty, they give a verdict of guilty, and then later they start talking and say, you know, I didn't really understand proof beyond a reasonable doubt. I thought it was preponderance. And the other members say, yeah, you know, we didn't really understand that. And they all come back and say, we circled guilty, but we really shouldn't have circled guilty because we just didn't understand what was going on there. So it was a mistake to circle guilty. How would that be different?
Your Honor, that would be different because it goes exclusively to the thought process or deliberative process of the members of the panel, and it goes particularly to their misunderstanding or misapplication of the law as instructed to them. Whereas in this case,
the counsel is that's we have the same scenario here. When you're looking at the language, we believed, we understood, we thought. That's all thought processes. That's all, you know, the conscious processes of the members of the panel. So, yeah, how will we distinguish Judge Maggs' scenario from the current scenario? Because the error here is, again, because we can see the affidavit, in understanding what was required in order to arrive at a finding of guilty. They didn't understand the vote numbers. So, but all the language that's used is that of mental processes. We didn't understand. So it's a process issue, not necessarily a clerical issue.
Appellant urges the court to consider just a very narrow scope of admissibility on the affidavit and to just consider the admissible portions, which is that they did reach a finding of not guilty and made a substantive mistake in not writing down that finding. And when the president later realized that it was a mistake not to write down that finding, he brought it to the court through this affidavit to raise that issue. To correct the findings worksheet. So this is not a clerical error, a Scrivener's error, but it is a substantive mistake that the president checked the votes and did not write down that finding of not guilty.
Is it so clearly objective? Let's say that we then had a panel member or multiple panel members who said, well, I didn't view that as a formal vote. I thought it was just simply, where do you stand right now in your thinking? Well, I want to talk about this more, so right now I'm not going to cast a guilty vote. I'm going to say it's not guilty. Wouldn't we have to be getting into things that are subjective? What was your thinking at that time when you either voted or simply were indicating whether you had come to a conclusion that you were willing to vote guilty at that point? Isn't there a slippery slope rather than a firm barrier between that which is objective and that which is internal deliberation?
Not in this case, Your Honor. The president is authorized to speak for the panel. He checks the count on the vote, so he is the authority to be able to say there was a vote and the finding was not guilty. He is the one who's responsible for writing down that finding. And he told the court through his affidavit, and I failed to do that. And I want to correct the mistake that I made in not writing down that finding. So because the president is the authority for speaking for the panel members, the court can give some weight to his affidavit in this case. To use the court's earlier example of, well, what would have happened if the court had simply asked each member, is this what you voted? Under military rules, we have a prohibition on polling the members. And part of that goes hand in hand with the secret written ballot to protect the integrity of voting for the members. Now, this court has identified the secret written ballot as a procedural safeguard for an accused, but in this case, because of the tension with a prohibition on polling, it actually harms appellant, and the only procedural safeguard left to ensure the validity and to have certainty in the verdict is MRE 606B2C.
I didn't mean to cut you off. I thought you were at the end of the sentence. This kind of goes along with chief judges. What if after the first vote was taken, consistent with the military judge's instructions, the someone asserted or requested reconsideration, the president comes back to the judge, says we'd like to do reconsideration, he opens the court, he authorizes them to do that, and they go back and they vote again. And they may end up doing that the same five number of times. Would that, till they ultimately got to the point of vote number five or six where he's convicted, would that be a correct conviction? Would that vote then be correct?
If I understand your question, Your Honor, if the verdict had come back and the judge on his own instructed reconsideration?
Well, no, they requested reconsideration, consistent with the instructions.
Yes, ma'am.
They requested reconsideration. He reopens. He retasks them. They go back and they vote. And maybe they do that five times. Each time they keep coming back requesting reconsideration. But they ultimately get to 6-2 and they fill out the findings worksheet. Would that then be a valid conviction in your view?
If that had happened, we wouldn't necessarily know the number of votes, but that would be in accordance with the rules, Your Honor, to request the reconsideration instruction and to go through the procedures. And then absent any admissible affidavit from a member saying something was wrong, there would be no reason to question the certainty of that verdict.
Captain Malcolm, is it possible that what might have happened here, and I'm asking genuinely, it's not a trick question, but is it possible that the members may have also or only have misunderstood the instructions on reconsideration? And let's suppose for the moment that that's what happened. In fact, they didn't understand or forgot what the judge had told them about reconsideration and just carried on as if they had asked for reconsideration. Is that possibly what happened in this case, or
Yes, Your Honor, it is possible that that is something that occurred. We don't have
now, that's different than what you think happened, isn't it?
It is, Your Honor, because there's no evidence that that is what occurred in this case based on the admissible evidence, well, based on the President's affidavit and the admissible portions of it. What the affidavit communicates is that they reached a finding of not guilty and then the President mistakenly did not write that down. And the military judge really incorrectly framed the question during the post-trial 39A by looking at the affidavit as a whole, not by considering line by line which parts of this are admissible, what parts can I consider. So he was incorrect in dismissing it in its entirety, and it really caused him to frame it as a question of misapplication of the law, which is not admissible under MRA 606B2C, and caused him to overlook the portions that clearly identified a substantive mistake in the findings worksheet. His misframing of the question also caused him to apply the corresponding case law incorrectly. He noted very few military cases on the topic that all predated the amendment to the rule of evidence that added this exception for mistakes on the findings worksheet, and misapplied the federal case law, which only talked about misunderstandings or misapplications of the law, but did not address genuine mistakes in the findings worksheet, which this is.
Counsel, could you address the issue of waiver?
Yes, Your Honor. So this issue is not waived. Appellant did not intentionally relinquish or abandon a known right. He made a timely objection once he became aware that there was a mistake entered into the findings worksheet. And since the discovery of the issue, appellant has continuously contested the findings worksheet and its purported reflection of the member vote. That has been his objection at the trial level, the lower court, and this court. It was initially raised at the lower court or at the trial court as under MRA 606B2C, the exact issue we're discussing today, and was raised under separate exceptions at the lower court. But the species of legal argument remained the same, and the basis of the objection remained the same, that there was an error in the findings worksheet. Your Honor, I see that my time is running low. May I briefly
Any questions complete? From the bench? You may conclude.
Thank you. The military judge should have amended the verdict to a finding of not guilty based on the admissible evidence in this case. Therefore, this court should dismiss the specification with prejudice. Thank you.
Thank you, Captain Malcolm. Lieutenant Burniff.
Is the volume good, Your Honors?
Yes, fine. Thank you for asking.
Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, and may it please the court. My name is Lieutenant Aaron Burniff, and along with Mr. Brian Keller, I represent the United States. This court should preserve the finality of appellant's verdict and hold that the military judge did not abuse his discretion in deeming the affidavit incompetent evidence for three main reasons. First, this court should apply the law of the case doctrine because appellant intentionally abandoned his pursuit of relief under the clerical error exception. Second, this court has long held that verdicts are final when they are formally and correctly announced in open court, and that misapplication of voting instructions is not an appropriate reason to impeach them. And then lastly, the clerical error exception in the military rules of evidence and the federal rules of evidence are identical, and civilian courts have uniformly held that the exception is meant for problems communicating a jury's final decision, not problems in how they arrived at that decision.
Okay. Yeah. Counsel, no, go ahead.
On the latter point, where you are seeking to have this court look towards FRE 606B, there are some important differences between civilian criminal justice practice and the military in terms of the panels are non-unanimous, there's no polling, the voting process. Every school child knows how it works in the civilian world, but to the uninitiated in particular, the military system is confusing. So why shouldn't we grant more leeway? Why should we, as the government urges, say we are going to follow exactly how federal civilian appellate courts interpret 606 FRE 606B to our interpretation of the military rule?
So to begin, Your Honor, this court in Loving from 1994 identified that with the exception of the part about UCI, the rules between the military and the federal courts are the exact same on this issue, and that continues to be the only difference between them. Regarding your concerns about the, like, you know, safeguards and differences in Anderson, this court held that the Sixth Amendment right to a jury trial is about, for service members, it's about having a fair and impartial jury, not unanimous voting. So the absence of jury polling in our system doesn't impact an appellant's right to a jury trial. And then in Lawson and Wilson from the CMA in 1983 and 1984, this court also identified that the whole purpose of our voting procedure rules, including the secret written ballots, including the rules of reconsideration, were to protect against UCI in deliberations. It's not meant to make the wall around jury deliberations paper thin that can be pierced at even the slightest allegation of an error in deliberations. And so to the extent this court is concerned about procedural protections for appellants in having their verdicts delivered, it has already answered all of those concerns in its prior decisions. And like in Anderson, it also identified other protections, like they still have to meet the beyond a reasonable doubt standard, they still have access to factual sufficiency review, and so the issue here is not going to strip away any pre-existing protections for an appellant by holding consistent with civilian courts that clerical errors cannot concern a juror's thought processes.
So, counsel, just to go back quickly, when you were enumerating your 3 points, and your first one was that with regards to law of the case, this court specified the issue. So what impact, if any, does that have on your argument that the appellant abandoned this argument at the interim court, intermediate court level?
So, Your Honor, the law of the case doctrine is always discretionary. So, you know, the fact that this court specified it, it can still choose to apply the doctrine. But regarding the argument that the appellant abandoned it, in the Eighth Circuit Crest decision, they found that someone had waived a verdict correction issue when they didn't raise it at the time of an original appeal. And similarly here, appellant knew that it was possible and that he had a right to a correct verdict under the clerical error exception. That's why he raised it at the trial level. But then he chose not to challenge that decision at the CCA. He tried to get in different evidence under the more robust inquiry permitted for the UCI exception. And then when he was denied that, once again in his petition to this court for review, he did not challenge the military judge's ruling. He only challenged the CCA's ruling on the UCI and the denial of different affidavits. And so under this court's doctrine, this court's decisions in Parker, Mack, and Lewis, it has always chosen, or not always, but it has chosen to apply the doctrine unless the earlier ruling is clearly erroneous or a manifest injustice, which is not this case.
Thank you.
Yes, Your Honor. Going to the second point, since we haven't discussed that yet, this court in True in London said that verdicts are only final once they have been formally and correctly announced in open court. We know that's what happened in this case. On pages 139 and 40 of the joint appendix, the military judge asked the senior member, has the panel reached findings? And he said, yes. The military judge asked him, are the findings that you reached reflected on the worksheet? He said, yes. The military judge then reviewed the findings worksheet and determined that it had been correctly filled out in accordance with its instructions. There was no problem there. He then gave it back to the senior member, and the senior member announced that they had found the appellant guilty for the second specification of sexual assault. That means that this case is almost identical to what happened in Loving. So there, this court said that the presumption that the jury or the panels had followed the military judge's instructions was reinforced by the fact that they announced their decision in court to sentence that appellant to death and that no one contested it at the time of its announcement. And so when the appellate defense counsel tried to present three different affidavits describing issues in how the panel voted to sentence the appellant to death, this court said that was not competent evidence. There was no evidence of UCI, no kind of other improper influence, and this court actually considered in Loving whether those affidavits counted as a clerical error. I'm sorry, Your Honor, was there a question?
No.
Okay. So this court considered whether they met the standard for a clerical error under United States v. Dotson from the Fifth Circuit in 1987. That's the exact same case that appellant cited in his original motion at the trial level and that he cited in his brief to this court on the specified issue. But in Loving, the court said that it those affidavits did not meet the standard for a clerical error exception because they didn't describe any kind of issue in communicating the decision to sentence that appellant to death. They only described at most a misunderstanding of how to vote and re-vote properly. And that's exactly what happened in this case. In opposing counsel's statement, they wanted this court to pay particular attention to line 8 of the affidavit to say that that had always been incorrect. But if you look at the second half of that line, it says that we didn't that they did not do so after each vote. So we know that there were multiple votes here. And the fact that there were does not mean that they never ultimately agreed on a finding of guilty. That is the line that civilian courts have drawn, and that is also the line that this court drew in Loving. So just to kind of further that point, Your Honor, Morris from the Third Circuit is, as far as the United States could find, the only appellate court that has considered what the clerical error exception is since the amendment was added to the federal rules in 2006. And there they said misapplication of instructions on determining the number of crack cocaine versus powder cocaine were not evidence of a clerical mistake because the juror's statement did not suggest the verdict contained a transcription error or inaccurately reflected their will. So the appellant is trying to argue that the findings worksheet inaccurately reflected their will, but what is absent from the affidavit is any statement saying, I accidentally said guilty when I meant not guilty. There is no statement saying I accidentally circled guilty when I said not guilty. What he says is, since the time that the findings worksheet was read aloud, I have learned I should have done something different. Had I known the proper procedure, I would have done something different. None of those things are contesting that they did agree to a finding of guilty as their final decision that they announced in court. And to the extent that this court is concerned about the number of votes here, in the Wilson case, there is a very helpful quote from United States v. Nash saying that even in the military, where we don't have unanimous votes, there are still valid reasons to allow multiple votes because, quote, it cannot be disputed that justice is more likely to be administered if there are full and free discussions full free discussions are not automatically cut off just because a vote was recorded. There is no evidence that anyone was pressured into reconsidering their votes. There is no evidence that they did not or that they disagreed with what the senior member announced. So as far as this court's own precedents are concerned, and as far as the civilian case law that is analogous to this is concerned, there is no clerical error here. So the judge's decision was not erroneous. It was not a manifest injustice, and this court should affirm it as not an abuse of discretion and preserve the finality of appellant's verdict. Pending any questions.
I see none. Thank you.
Yes, Your Honor.
Captain Malcolm.
The admissible portions of the President's affidavit show that he made a mistake through inadvertence, mistake, or oversight in writing the verdict on the findings worksheet. That language does come from the federal case law, Carl v. Burlington, that the court may accept juror testimony under the exception when the juror's testimony indicates through inadvertence, oversight, or mistake that the verdict announced was not the verdict on which the jurors agreed. And in this case, we do have competent evidence in the form of the President's affidavit that there was a mistake. What's admissible is that they voted, they came to an agreement, and he should have written that verdict down. That's the President's conclusion, is that that was the verdict, and he came to realize through mistake, oversight, that he should have written that down. And he communicates to the court that he would like to correct the findings worksheet because, as it stands, it does not accurately reflect the will of the jury. That is a correctable mistake, and the military judge in this case should have and could have, at the time, amended the verdict to a finding of not guilty. Because the military judge could have considered the affidavit and should have considered the affidavit, could have produced the President to ask that question, does this verdict accurately reflect the will of the jury in this case? And did not do so, appellant was acquitted but stands before this court convicted. And this court can effectuate that acquittal by dismissing the specification with prejudice. Barring any questions from the court, thank you.
Thank you. The case is now submitted. The court thanks counsel for both sides, and the court will stand adjourned until further order of the court.
All rise. The court stands adjourned until further order of the court.